Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 34 with brother-sister duo Cheryl and Greg Broderick of Ballypatrick Stables in County Tipperary, Ireland. Of course, the Irish listeners will be very familiar with Ballypatrick. For our international listeners, many will have come across the Ballypatrick team at the Young Horse World Championships in Lanaken, Belgium, where they've enjoyed tremendous success in recent years. The breeding program in Ballypatrick has grown to become one of Ireland's largest sport horse breeding programs. We cover a wide range of topics in this episode, including assessing young horses, attracting and retaining top young riders, how Ballypatrick manage their young sport mares while also doing embryo transfer as part of the breeding program, selecting future stallions, the road to the Olympics with Greg's former partner MHS Going Global, as well as some extremely useful advice for the young breeders and young riders of the future. The team here are obviously in the final throes of the preparations for the third edition of the upcoming Ballypatrick auction, which is going to be on the 28th of December. So I'm extra appreciative that you've taken the time to do this interview in the middle of all that. In the past decade, Ballypatrick has grown into probably the largest sport horse breeding program in the country and one of the most dominant sport stables in the country. But particularly for the international listeners or those less, say, familiar with the breeding and sport stable elements, could we just get an idea of the kind of numbers that you're operating at in terms of the breeding program and the sport stable and how many horses are being managed? So maybe on the breeding front, if you wouldn't mind starting, Cheryl, and just giving people a flavour for what size the breeding program has grown to at the moment.
I suppose we probably aim to have an average between 40 and 50 foals born a year, mostly from our own mares that are Greg has jumped, or mares that are jumping in the system here in the jumping yard at the moment. And then we obviously buy in some foals also throughout the season, so we end up probably with in around 50 foals every year.
Okay. Of those, roughly how many mares, just full-time brood mares, would there be in that mix versus, say, for instance, a lot might be multiples from some of the sport mares in that, but are there many that are full-time,
probably,
or is
about
it
half and half? Yeah. Okay. Some of them are obviously retired and they do some embryo work, and they might take one embryo from them, we might put them in fold. Others are still in jumping programs, so we just fully concentrate on just embryos from them whenever they have a couple of weeks off. So it really depends on where they're at in their jumping career at the time.
Okay. On top of that, then, you're buying quite a few foals on top of what you bred?
Yeah, we did. I think I've been very lucky with it. I suppose we have the setup for it. We have the land and we have a lot more of the facilities, sheds and stuff, terrarium horses now. And I suppose over the years you build up a relationship with breeders, not only in Ireland but in Belgium or Holland, or probably in particular Belgium with us. And so then you end up maybe buying some good foals, or you have some good horses jumping, so you try to pick up some of the relations and whatnot, and you kind of try to add them into what you have and give yourself the best chance, I suppose. And then we generally let them stay around until they're 3-year-olds and then start to make our selections from there.
Okay. In terms of the 3-year-old selections, what do they look like when you're bringing them in? What are the questions that you're asking from them, or what does your process typically look like to assess those 3-year-olds?
Well, I suppose you've seen a lot of the types in the fields, and mm-hmm. like from the times they're young or in the sheds or in the fields. See, there would be ones, like everyone as breeders, like I suppose generally there's always horses that you're looking forward to jumping, you know, when a group comes in there's ones you'd be kind of looking forward to jumping first, or there's ones you'd expect to jump good because you just see the characteristics of them, or the balance, or the types, they look like jumpers. So that would be the thing. But the main thing for us is, some of the main things for us is, sure, of course the jump is important, but probably the biggest thing that I've changed over the years in my way of looking at the horses, if they don't have a nice balance in the canter, then I would not gravitate towards them, I'd gravitate away from them. Only because it's different if you're breeding a horse to 3-year-old and you're selling it and you have to forget about it, but for us, then we keep them, we put them under the saddle, and you start to see the defects of horses that have poor mechanics in the canter. Like we do, as show jumpers, you're doing so much of your work in canter. So if you have a horse that has a soft canter or a nice balanced canter, generally they have a nice mouth because they can carry themselves well.
Yeah.
And they're just so much more trainable. The work is enjoyable for the horses, so they enjoy the work because it's not hard for them. You're not changing their natural way of going. You're just working with what, a lot of what they have naturally in their canter gates. So that's a massive thing. But I do think, since I started, one thing I would say when I started, everybody would have, in Ireland in particular, people would have been a lot about how the horse trots and stuff. I suppose the biggest thing since in my time doing it, when I started it, a lot of the time would be to trot the horse up or see a horse moving and trot. And I think that's something that's really changed, in the sense that everything is just more focused on the canter and how the horse canters now. And I didn't come from a show jumping background, or my parents didn't ride so much, so I suppose you have to learn a lot as you go. And then that was probably the biggest thing, is that when you bring the horses from jumping as 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, and then you start to actually have to ride the horses, she just learned so much about what you see in them as 2 and 3-year-olds. And there are several horses I've had along the way that were good jumpers, but their canters were a little bit unbalanced. Or like, in particular, you see it when you're free jumping on the short sides of the small arenas. When they come around the short side, the horses that are weak canters, they switch off their canter leads, and when they straighten up, sometimes they can't back off. So they always, sometimes when they're on a nice distance coming out of turn, they can end up a bit too close because they're just not able to hold their canters. Generally, those horses, when you sit up to ride them, you're always, you end up in sometimes having, they're a little bit offside with you, or there's some arguments with the flat work because they just can't carry themselves as well as the ones that are well balanced. And I just find the horses that have that good balance are just easier to train, they enjoy it more. And it's like ourselves, if you enjoy something, you get better at it. So of course there's freaks along the way, but then as well as that, the American market has been a huge, has fueled our business massively. So then if you have horses that have nice canter balance that are nice to ride, the ones that you produce even up to 130, 135, 140 level, they still have a very good value. And those horses, if you can sell them good to that market, then you're getting some money back to reinvest into your business, and you can buy better mares or better foals, and it all kind of brings the whole thing up and up. And then when you hit on a superstar, so we're all dreaming of that, but there's a lot of in between, and bread and butter work with nice horses in between times.
When you get to the stage when, say, these youngsters, either the ones you bought or you breed, are coming in under saddle, like in the last few years, when the Ballypatrick crew turn up with the young horse classes throughout the country, like you've dominated a lot of the young horse classes, and you've had some incredible success in Dublin. Like, you had a clean sweep a few years ago there of all the young horse classes. Roughly, at any one time here, how many horses would be in work actually under saddle?
There'd be 80 horses riding generally. At the moment with the auction, there's maybe, I suppose it could be 100, maybe 90 to 100, I'm not exactly sure.
Okay.
But generally, the general run in the mill would be between 70 and 80 horses. It runs fairly smoothly, like everybody knows their job, and the thing goes fairly straightforward,
yeah,
I'd say. And it's good for us because we have a lot of horses. There's always, when the young riders want to come, or people want to come and train and learn, there's so many horses.
No end to it, yeah.
People can ride all day. And then if the young riders are coming and they get to see riders that are riding at 3 and 4 and 5 star level, and they're riding around the same arenas as them, like, you can't underestimate that, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the bigger stables, not all, but some of the bigger stables, are riders, they're away a lot, or they don't carry large numbers of horses, so of course you can learn massive amounts off them. But young riders want to be in the saddle, you want to be riding, you want to be jumping, you want to be in the thick of it.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's a big benefit for younger riders that come here, and it's a good thing for us because good riders make good horses, and then you can attract the better riders to come when they get more saddle time, and they can watch good riders and watch a good system, so it kind of complements each other.
Yeah. In terms of some of those sport mares that say lots of the mares that have come through the sports stable over the years, as you mentioned, they've been involved or they've been doing embryo transfer in the breeding program. But there have also been some interesting mares, past competition mares, that have either been produced here and have retired to the breeding program, or some special mares that have retired from other people and come to spend the rest of their years breeding here. Would you give us a flavour of some of those, some of the maybe more successful competition mares, your own or other people's, that are now involved in the breeding program?
Well, I suppose my favourite would always be, my favourite is Mrs. Quinn.
Yeah.
I think, you know, back, I looked at her page the other day, and she was born in 1999, you know, and she's still the boss in the field. And she goes in the field with Going Global's sister, Ballypatrick Flight. The two of them are as thick as thieves. But she has been incredible, you know, not only in the sport, but also as a broodmare, you know. And she was probably one of the first that came back. And Lee Kruger was really good, that owned Going Global. She had her and she sent her back to Ireland. And Greg rode her and won many Grand Prix on her in international classes. And then, she retired here. And so we were sold. And then when Going Global was sold, she gave me a present of Mrs. Quinn, you know. And
That's lovely.
When I got married, instead of having a, you know, book that the guests sign, I had a blow up version of Mrs. Quinn, and the border on the picture was thicker, so everybody had to sign that for me.
Yeah.
Like, so I mean, she's like, she's part of the family here, so I'd die if anything happened to her, like, you know. But she's really fit and healthy, and she's perfect in the field. So, and sure, obviously Ballypatrick Flight has been a great servant to us as well. She was we bought her before Going Global came, so we were actually very lucky to get into that family early. And obviously she bred Limitless, and we have some very nice young horses coming from her, and also the next generation coming out of her daughters again are jumping very good, and we have some lovely 3-year-olds coming from that. So it's not just directly from her, it's her offspring now coming from her grandchildren are really going well.
Coming through.
Yeah, it's brilliant because like I often find those strong pedigrees, you know, they keep coming through in the different generations. So obviously the Brennans are renowned for their breeding as well, so it's lovely to have some of that pedigree here too.
And actually just on that, is there a mare or are there particularly a few mares in particular that are really, really putting their stamp on the offspring? Like that you see it, and especially when you're seeing the folds in the fields or when you're seeing them come through to the sports stable here, where the mares are really, really putting their stamp on their youngsters in terms of what you're seeing so far.
I'd say we have one cruising mare called Masterpiece. Is she Ballypatrick Masterpiece or BP Masterpiece? She's a very nice mare. She competed up to sort of national Grand Prix level herself, and she had a slight injury, and we could have actually brought her back from the injury, but to be honest, she was cruising Cavalier Diamond Lad, so it was a nice, she had a nice pedigree, and her idea was always to breed with her, so we just continued and started to breed. And the nice thing about her is that her offspring are very modern, like they have nice balance in the canters, they have nice mouths, nice horses to work with. And I would say that she's probably one of our, I would say that line I'm very, very fond of, because she bred BP Wakita, who's been clearing some 5-star Grand Prix already, and she's doing well. But she had BP Lady Masterpiece, was the champion in Dublin last year. She's 5 now in the Montesemini mare. She's a proper mare. She's a Ballybay, there's a Ballybay out of her that's jumping 150. There's several nice horses out of her.
The one that was third in Dublin also last year.
Yeah.
Wishes.
Wishes, sorry. Wishes was second in Dublin, actually.
Yeah. And
so our 2 4-year-old mares were... BP Wakita was reserve champion as a 5-year-old in Dublin, and BP Masterpiece was the winner of the 4-year-olds, and her BP Wishes was reserve champion as well. So all her offspring are doing well. But like that, like BP Wakita was always ridden in a rubber snaff and just beautiful balance. And... the BP Wishes, when you ride her with your little finger, like, she's just so well balanced. And Lady Masterpiece, the same thing, she's in a rubber snaffle, but just very modern, very well balanced. So like, I think all those 3 horses I mentioned will jump. Well, Wakita's already jumping good Grand Prix level, but the next 2 coming, those 2 that I'm speaking about, will be horses will definitely jump to 150 level, and we'll see. She never know exactly after that, but they're lovely horses to ride as well. So like, I would say that, like, for instance, if you have a nice client in America, like a girl who wants to jump down 145 and 150 on a very comfortable horse, they're going to do that definitely, and you hope that they're going to take the next step that they can be 160 horses as well, but we'll see when the time comes with that. But when you asked about a mare leaving her stamping, I think that's, they have the cleverness from the cruising,
yeah,
but they have the balance from the cavalier as well, and I think that's worked very well with that mare. I've found that a lot of the time when you have cruising, you had Diamond Lad or King of Diamonds or these kind of dam lines behind, which are very good, but I found just from riding them, they were very smart horses and very, very, very good horses. But if you have one more cross of continental blood, you got more modernness in the canter. And I think that mare in particular, with the cavalier and cruising, and then when you get another cross into it, you get the cleverness from the cruising and that real, real instinctiveness in front of the jump. But you also have them a little bit nicer to ride. So that's kind of, you're getting the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
So that's why I like that mare probably really a lot, to be honest.
What's nice to see, it's probably more in recent years, and maybe in the past 10 years, that you've probably really upped the ante on the breeding program. But it's nice that even some of the earlier ones have said she would have been in the earlier part of the breeding program, that their offspring are coming through, like what you mentioned, the horses coming to Grand Prix, or the likes of in Paris, where you had the horse with the Brazilian rider eventing, doing the Olympics. So it's nice to see. With the mares that are doing the sport and the breeding, is there anything in particular that you do differently to manage them? I know each horse is an individual, but when they're back and forth doing their embryos and in and out of the sport stable, do you see in any particular cases where you see that having a potentially negative effect? And do you treat them differently when they're, say, doing the embryo transfer work, to the normal mare that's just in work?
I think it's more down to the individual. Some of them are very, like, some of them are very fussy when you start to do some embryo transfers, definitely. So I'm not sure if it's just all about hormonal. I'm sure some of them are a little bit sore from the scanning and the handling. I would say more uncomfortable than sore.
Okay.
But I would say here we're very, like, we're lucky in the sense that the mare's breeding farm works well with the jumping farm, so they're not out of work for days to go and do that sort of thing. So they generally stay fairly well in their routine, but you would keep an eye on things, and you would back off to work and just let them hack out and put them in the paddock for a few days if you thought there was a little bit of an issue. But there's definitely, I would say 80 to 90% of the mares have been fine, but there is mares that are there that you would know that if you go down that road, they're going to lose form for a number of months, and it takes them a little while to get back on track. So maybe two or three mares that are like that they do change in their character, and the jump is not the same. So then you have to decide, if you're trying to sell a horse that in that particular year and you're doing embryos, it's probably not, well, it's definitely not the wisest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
you have to figure out what's your goal. But like, there's certain mares, if I believed in them enough, or if we believed in them enough that we were going to do embryos, then generally we like them. And if you say, well, we're going to keep that mare and breed off her and jump her up till at least she's an 8 or 9 year old, for instance, before we'd even think about selling her. If you have a middling year as a 6 year old or a 7 year old, but you have 3 or 4 foals from her, I'd far rather that than have a good 6 or 7 year old year and have no foals from your best mare or one of them coming through. So that's a little bit the way I look at it.
Yeah.
If you've jumped your horse and you know it's going to be one of your best ones, and we're at it long enough now that we should know the good ones from the normal ones, and you decide to go down the embryo transfer route, and you're doing it, and you get a bit of a speed wobble, for instance, or the results are not as good for a few months, but you're still going to the show and you're still jumping them, but instead of it being the standout horse, maybe it's having a fence down, or it's the rideability is not as good.
Yeah.
But you're still giving the horse the mileage, and it's still learning its job. And you know that when you really focus on shows and making a show plan rather than a breeding plan, that it should go the way it should. Generally, that's always worked out for us so far anyways. But
okay,
as I said, it's not that we're at it for years and years, but from what we've done of it so far, I think it, once you back off with the embryos again and the breeding side of things, that most of them do start to get back into proper routine.
Yeah.
And as I say, for me, is that I'd rather have a middling 2 or 3 months with a mare if you know that it's only happening because maybe they're just not in the same routine or in the same shape because they've been breeding a bit. As long as they're still getting to the show, they're still getting some mileage, and they're not getting completely left behind,
then
so be it. If you know what I mean, if you want to be a breeder and have foals from your best mares, you want to have to take a few sacrifices every now and again. So,
and in a practical way, when you said the breeding and the sport here, it's very intertwined, and I was going to say you're very lucky, but it didn't happen by chance. You put a lot of effort and investment into building the facility at the breeding farm, and you seem to work well together from what I see. But in a practical way, how does that stallion selection process work for you?
Well,
in terms
just,
of together, you know,
oh,
in terms of in terms of your discussions together and settling on a given breeding or a stallion or combination for a given mare.
Like, just from my point of view, I suppose we don't castrate. Like, luckily enough, we hope that we have, you know, anything that we have as a colt now, even when they're born, that they have a very strong pedigree, so they have a chance. They're bred to be a colt, whether they're the type to be a colt, whether they jump enough to be a colt, that time will tell. But we generally don't castrate them till they're a couple of years old, you know. So now, for example, now I'm looking forward to the 2-year-olds coming in, and obviously there's a big bunch of them, so I start to bring them in bunches of 6 or 7 or 8 or whatever, you know, and then I start to do a bit with them, lead them, get them going left and right in the arenas, and start to jump small fences with them, you know, so that they start to know their job and start to loose jump. And then Greg will come over then as well and make the final decisions on what is, you know, what will stay a stallion, what won't stay a stallion, you know, what is looking good and what isn't, you know. Obviously, X-raying is a big part of the business now, so that's very important, becoming more and more important when it comes to selling, but also for your stallion selections and what they can go forward as a stallion, you know. But, you know, as a 2-year-old, you start to see glimpses of them, what they're like, what the canter is like, the type, the balance, the attitude, all of that. And so we do that a lot now from the 2-year-olds on. And it's nice to see them and see what we have coming through and see what our next stallions are, you know, for us 3-year-olds. Because in Ireland, a 3-year-old stallion is very popular here. They're probably the busiest. A good 3-year-old stallion is more popular than some of the 5- and 6-year-old stallions in Ireland. So it's always good for us to have a young,
Hardy older ones, to be honest.
Ones,
people really seem to gravitate towards young stallions, a lot of people here. If you're talking about the selections for the mares, for
that's,
the semen.
Yeah,
oh, sorry,
that's,
I touched
no,
my
no,
stallion.
No, but that's because that's actually something I wanted to get onto later. But with the stallion selections, in terms of what's great in this situation, to be so interconnected, a breeding program and a sports stable is massively beneficial to both, but also you're very active in following what's actually happening in the sport yourself anyway. But I was just wondering, in a practical way, when it comes to picking the stallions for any given mare, any combination, how do you work that out and finalise that between the two of you?
Shouldn't we just chat it over and back? I wouldn't say it's any rocket science, definitely not, but you would definitely, I would say, for start off, the fertility of the stallions is a thing. Because if Cheryl has semen that's working well, or we're getting good pregnancies from it, from a stallion that we like, we would gravitate towards that. Because when you go down the route of having mares that are ovulating, or you're flushing embryos and this, and then you're using semen that's not working, that's a kick in the ass when you do it like that. First thing I would personally anyway, I'd ask Cheryl is what stallions are working well for us at the moment. If she had a good batch of semen, because you might get a certain batch of straws that are not working well, or he gets straws from a stallion from a different date that are working really well. Like, I would say that happens regularly for sure, doesn't
definitely,
it?
Definitely, yeah.
So, and then like if you could jump a bunch of 3-year-olds or a bunch of 2-year-olds, and you see how certain horses are working with our mares, so you'd use that a little bit. But I suppose the way we've done it so far is probably, if a stallion was working well for us during the year, we probably would use him a good bit. So like we use Staccato Gold outside of our own stallions. We don't try not to use all our own stallions on the mares. We try to give our young stallions a chance in some of the mares and then use some of the tried and tested as well. So if you stick to the tried and tested ones, like we used Staccato Gold one year, it was very lucky for us. It worked well and we have very good horses from it. I think there's a bunch of Agonixes now, 3 and 4 year olds, and to be honest, overall I would say we're very happy with them. And then now we've Hermitage Cologne coming a good bit and we seem to like them. So like with the older stallions, to be honest, we don't reinvent the wheel, we just use what's tried and what's tested. And if the semen is working well, we'll continue to use it if we're having good, the fertility is working well with the mares. And then I suppose if there is, we wouldn't overthink it, but if there is defects with the mares that we're using, we would probably try and match that up a little bit, like as best we can. But for instance, it might sound silly, but I suppose when if you ask something about a defect in her own head, the mare I spoke to you about, Masterpiece, is a cruising cavalier, Diamond Lad. She had fantastic technique, but she stayed very low at her shoulders. Like she'd bend her legs very quickly. She wouldn't get her belly very high over the jumps. And then if you think what worked well with her, we used Pacino. Pacino was very long in the front legs. Mm. But horses that are long in front sometimes, like in their technique, they really bring their body and their shoulders back and they get their bodies very high over the fence. And that worked well with her because her defect was that she'd stay very low her set with her body over the fence, even though she's quick with her legs. And when we used, like Pacino, as I said, was quite long with his technique and got his body very high. But that cross with her worked very well because she bred Waikita, who was kind of a mix in the middle. She doesn't go super high over the fence, but she's higher than her mother, but not as high as her father. Actually, that worked quite well. And then when I thought about it, we used Vigo on her, which didn't work amazing, but Vigo was a bit like the mother. He had very good technique, but didn't get so much body height. And we used Conair, who was a bit the same. Great technique, but didn't get body height. And then the next very good one, Balobe, worked well with her. Long technique in front, so he had to bring his body high. And then Diamante Semele is next, is very good. Same thing. And so it's actually interesting that the horses, when we thought about it, the horses that had, even though they were top horses, the ones that didn't bring their bodies very high didn't breed good with her. And the horses that had long technique in front work very good with her. But that's just, so that's one thing that, it's not to say that maybe there won't be a superstar Vigo or some of them other stallions I'm talking about out of her. It doesn't always work like that, but yeah. I suppose when we actually thought about it, that was one
and thing. I think that's good for our yard, where for me as a breeder, like that I have the support of, you know, Greg's knowledge there and the riders that are riding them day in, day out, because a lot of breeders I think are in a situation now where they have to breed, they have to decide whether they're going to breed for the commercial reasons or they're going to breed for longevity, and 9 times out of 10 a breeder wants probably to sell them as a foal. So that means that some sires are fashionable from year to year, so they're going to use those, you know, that's the problem there. They're going to use, like, you know, Knight of Touches, they're going for Ixie, they're going to use Hermitage Cologne, they're going to use the sires that are going to sell. But that doesn't normally, sometimes it will work with your mare, sometimes it doesn't, but you have some times breeders just have to use what is going to be fancy on the page, you know. So that's where you have to kind of, I suppose that's where you decide as a breeder which direction you're going, you know.
The other element is the level of feedback. The insight is one thing, but it's the fact that the mares are potentially bred here, have come through the sport stable. By the time, even if it's just going over for an embryo as a young mare, and they're going over to the breeding farm, or you have so much information on them already, versus, you know, the average breeder is kind of making their best guesstimates in terms of what a mare could have been or should have been.
Even like a mare that we have... you know, the mares that are 4 year olds, we can have 2 embryos gone off them by the time they're you know, to the mare that won the 4 year old Lady Masterpiece. But it's nice for them to see, like, what's going to work with that mare again. Like, that mare is still in work here, the mother, and then you have 2 coming behind her. So you start to see early what crosses are working and what crosses are definitely not working, you know, within a few years. So I think that's a good insight for breeders also. So, you know, it might be the same stallion every year, so you can say, okay, that worked, but this one definitely didn't work, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
you kind of can figure things out. And then, obviously, we've some of the best riders in Europe here.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting, as a breeder, you know, to get their feedback and what they think and what the feeling they have is worth its weight in gold for me, you know?
Yeah, and the average, for the most part, I know horses can be unlucky in any system and things can happen or go wrong or accidents, but on average, the young horses get such a chance, because often you have, you know, a breeder, they're trying to decide which person to go to for breaking or which person to go for riding, and you're trying to do the best thing, but your options are often limited. But
of course,
but the fact that everything can be done in house in a very controlled environment, broken in the way that you want, and then go to some of this talented group of young riders here. And then, and it's not just also that you can have talented young riders that aren't necessarily young horse producers, but then that they're being mentored or molded in terms of, you know, how best to do that as well. It's like, so every horse is getting probably the above average chance versus the next breeding program, which is great. Something I wanted to ask you about at the breeding farm, I know a few months back during the summer, I got a look around with it, and it was incredible. I'd obviously seen the videos on social media, but to actually see it and go around in the level of thought and detail and investment is just, it's crazy. I was curious if you had to do it again, are there things in it that you would change?
Well, I think for me, I don't know myself with the setup now, but, you know, it's amazing. Horses are really happy. I like the idea where, if you've seen the sheds, where they go outside, inside. I think it saves a lot on bedding, but also the horses are happier outside in the sheds, you know. We have a system where you just go in with a scraper out in front of you and you just scrape off the concrete a couple of times a week, and that works really well. I think they're healthier, you know, as well, rather than a closed-in shed. I just feel that the horses are healthier and there's more air going through the sheds, it's not stuffy. Obviously, when you build a place, you think you've loads of room, but then you realise, because we have a lot of mares and fillies, that they do fight a bit. And then, you know, some of them, there's horses that you probably think that you could fit maybe 10 in there, but you realise that those mares are not going to get on together, so you have to split them up and you only end up with 5 or 6 in there, and you have to move things around to... So you could build 10 more sheds and you could still probably fill them,
problem,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, the same problem, especially with mares, as you probably know yourself, like, but, you know, really it's working really, really, really well. And what I find for staff as well working with me is that, you know, myself and one other can easily feed, like, so many horses. It's unbelievable. The easiest thing for me is that there's so many horses in, but... You know, two people can feed so many horses in a short space of time. Obviously, you're feeding the haylage in front, but at the back where we have, where you can drive down the quad and you can give them nuts from the outside, that has become really, it's a much safer option for, you know, we used to have the blue barrels and you'd have to go in, but that's fine. But if you're going into the middle of young colts and horses, you know,
that's lethal.
Yeah. So that, for every reason, it's just really, really good. Also, I like the idea of, it was Greg's idea actually, to put the water troughs outside.
Yeah.
And that has worked really well, because you know yourself, when you're, if the horses, like, obviously they get dirty or they shite inside one or whatever, at least it's all outside and that doesn't happen. It's only small things, but you'd be surprised, like, or they kick it and it starts leaking, and that all has I really recommend that one as well. And and it's so easy just to drive down with your quad, with your bucket, and just fill down along. The horses become very used to everything. It works really well. Also, with the horses going outside, they spend so much time in the yard that their actual straw beds are lasting way longer, which I was very surprised about. And hail, rain, or snow, they're outside in the yard. You know, they're not going in. They're just going to lie down and come back out again. So actually, we're saving an awful lot on bedding.
Yeah, the bedding is huge.
Yeah. That has been a big surprise for us also, you know.
With the layout and the design, because you were starting largely with kind of a green field, it's kind of a blank canvas, but in some places on the farm, how the paddocks even met together and how the gates were done almost like hexagonally, I thought that was very clever in how you could make such a safe area if you had to take one out of a group.
Yeah.
That was something that I really, really liked, that you could take one out, it's confined, it can't go anywhere, and then you can either walk it back or load it up and whatever,
yeah,
in the box. Or thought that was something simple when you see it, but it actually...
I know, but it's like everything, if you're around and you see people that have done these things before us, you get great ideas. Do all the paddocks lead into one area that's built like that, like a pen with four or five gates from different fields to there. I saw that in a thoroughbred farm in Conranans in Bansha, and he had great ideas, but he does thoroughbreds.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a great idea, so we put a couple of them at different parts of the farm, because you can imagine having young stallions around the farm in different areas, or if there's horses along roadways and stuff, and next thing there's one horse with a drop or a little cut or sick, and you need to bring it in, and next thing you need to run it up all the way up to the farm, and it's running past all these horses, so there's commotion like this to get it to the yard where you can catch it. Whereas those areas are not hard built, like, so what is it really, only maybe four or five gates and some railing around, and just lead your, there's a bit of designing in it, but at least if you have a sick horse or something, you need to get one in, you're not bringing it all the way up the farm.
Yeah.
Or as well as that, like if you have young horses, six or seven young horses out in the field together, and you want to bring one in to start working it again, like sometimes they'll stand in the field for you, but sometimes they just won't.
Yeah.
You just run them into the pen and catch them. Like, just about making things practical, but sure, it's like everything. We worked without greenfield sites, and we just made do with what we had for many years, and you make it work. And it's just, that's the first time we've probably done something, as you said, from a little bit of a blank canvas. So I suppose we should. Of course, then you want to try and put all the good ideas you've seen in the different yards and different studs, because you do see some great ideas around.
Yeah.
And if you're dealing with that amount of horses, you better have things as practical as possible, because it's still, like, there's plenty of things we could probably improve on. But I suppose it is overall a practical setup for the amount of horses that we have there now, but you definitely need it, you know.
Definitely, yeah. Super. With the breeding program, one more thing that I was curious on. You've added a lot of very interesting genetics, and it's adding all the time. Either the embryos you're doing from sport mares here, you know, buying fillies or buying embryos. If there was any mare competing internationally at the moment, that you could take her and put her full time in your breeding program, who would you take?
I think that's, this week is a fairly easy answer now. Foxy the other Oxford.
Yeah.
I think it's
yeah.
the best horse I ever saw in my life, to be honest.
Good luck to you getting her off Kyle Cook.
I don't think it's happening, but I thought it was unbelievable watching in rehab, because she's no boots behind. Like, it's all so, like, it looks so natural. But an incredible horse, like how she jumps and the way she used herself, just everything about it, I just thought it was amazing to watch them, to be honest. So I suppose that's the dream, like when you see that family, Michelle Heckar and his family, whatever, they had Caracol de la Roc, and now Foxy de la Roc both gone to Carol
mm-hmm.
Cook, and I don't know what the numbers were, but a massive amount of money. But the money aside, like, suppose if you do anything well in horses and you put your heart and soul into it and you end up bringing the best of horses through, like, money will follow in spite of you nearly. But so it's not all about money, but like, just to have bred, they bred plenty of good horses, but like, say Caracol in modern day era and Foxy de la Roc from the same farm, like, that's incredible, like, incredible. So it's just brilliant to see, really, to be honest.
And it's one thing from the same farm to have the two at the top of their game in the same year, and like Caracol,
unbelievable, and to have brought them through to that level and kept them to that level. Like, I wouldn't say that people don't realise, of course some people do realise, but like, it's such a long road, like, it's just incredible for everything to line up for a horse to get from like a foal or a cover and a mare, for it to arrive. Like, if we talk about in breeding terms in Ireland, like the likes of where Pacino Amiro ended up, or Kilkenny, or James Ken Cruz, or Going Global, or these horses, like, the amount of water that has to go under the bridge. I don't care how nice the foal is, I don't care how good it jumps as a 3-year-old, I don't care how good it looks as a 4-year-old to qualify for Dublin, or in Dublin if it goes down that route, or Lanaken, or Dalida. For it to stay sound enough, and everything stay right, and for the horse to stay lucky enough, for it to get to 160 level, like, there's so much goes into it. Like nowadays with good physios, good farriers, like he gets a lot of feet problems. To keep the horses sound, you need such good vets in your corner. Like it's constant, like, to keep the horses in good shape. And like it's so easy to get excited about free jumping 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, but it is like very nice to see a good group of horses and jump them, and like it gives you a bit of a drive on to stay at it and put more into it. But if you're thinking about bringing the horses from that level to where we're talking about Foxy Della Rock or Caracol Della Rock, getting them to the very highest stage, like there's so much has to go right and go in your way, like for the horses to, I don't care how good a judge you are, how good they look at that age, for them to arrive at that level is, there's a huge, huge, huge amount to it. Like, so hats off to everybody that's doing it. Like I think that's our goal, and I think we're still in a little bit in our infancy in doing it, and hopefully we're on the right track. But sure, it would be the dream to do more of that, to see some of those horses, and even just to have the knowledge and to live through seeing more of those horses coming from how they were at 3 and 4 and how they developed and what you could do and what you could do differently than with the next one that you get very good. And actually you're constantly learning and figuring it out, you know.
Because that's the thing, actually, there was a breeder years ago in Holland had made that, but in terms of knowing what a good horse is, we all aspire to breed this horse that a lot of us have never actually lived with or been exposed to. And he said, like, until you have that horse in your hand, you really don't have an appreciation for, you know, what that horse is. And that's the point, I suppose, to live. When you get to experience some of those special horses, I guess you know what you're trying to strive for.
Definitely, definitely.
In terms of running the sports stable and trying to build what you're building here, what you have built here, what are the greatest challenges facing trying to, like, run or operate a stable like this?
I suppose the biggest, when you say the biggest challenges, I suppose go a little bit off track. What I often say was the biggest change for me over the years is when I started off, like, we didn't have this indoor where we're sitting now or those nice stables out there, which was fine. What we had was a sandrine at the back of the house and maybe 20 stables. And you got up every day and you just got on a horse and rode all day. You had 2 or 3 people helping you. And you would go to the show twice a week, mostly 90% national shows with the young horses. Ring the owners on the way home in the lorry, driving down the motorway or the road or whatever, and do the same thing the following week. And it was just, basically it was yourself and the horses, and not so many people involved. Now it's like, it could be, if you wanted, it could be 90% people and 10% horses if you weren't careful. Because when the business starts to get big and you have more owners or you have more clients looking for horses to buy them, you have so many staff and different people and different characters, and there's just constantly problems. So if you weren't careful, what made Ballypatrick in the first place couldn't slip away from you if you're not careful, like, if you know what I mean. I think what got this place on the road is what we were able to do with the horses, and it still is, don't get me wrong. But if you're not careful, you can get caught up in a lot of dealing with people rather than actually really focusing on keeping the horses happy and doing the best for the horses. And that's probably the biggest change for me, was, like, we're not educated on, if you're becoming successful with what you can do with a horse, you're not educated on how to keep people happy or how to manage staff or how to do all that sort of thing. So you're learning that as you go. And
yeah, it's not really stable with the HR department.
No,
yeah.
Definitely not. And I would say that I'm probably a disaster at it, to be honest. But she tried to just keep figuring out how to do it better. And I think that's where Cheryl is good with the breeding side of things. My other sister, Olga, is involved with us now as well. And she takes a lot of pressure off of that sort of thing. She's a very good people's person and stuff like that. So I'd say that's probably the biggest change, is learning to manage that well, but still focus on, like, what's the importance of how the horses are going and that they're getting well taken care of, and that you're doing as much as you can for them. Do you know what I mean? So that's.
But it's great that you all have your niche. Like, you've all found your niche. It's not that. I suppose there are advantages, obviously, if everyone's trying to be a rider, it drives everyone on. But the fact the fact that you all have your niche and you can all
complement each other.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, like, I don't want to do what Cheryl does. My sister Olga definitely doesn't want to do what Cheryl does.
Yeah.
And Cheryl doesn't want to ride the horses. And we all, as you say, we do have our own niche. I like breeding, I love young horses, but it wouldn't be, definitely the breeding wouldn't develop as much as it did, only for what Cheryl can oversee and manage that. And Olga's been a huge part of the business as well for the HR things,
yeah.
Like what you said, and as well as she's smart, she's a good people's person, and she's just a very good person to have involved in different ways as well. She's great with clients,
yeah.
As well, managing staff and overseeing that sort of thing, and the rest of the team that are, obviously you can't do it without them, and then it takes a lot of pressure off me to kind of keep doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
Over the years, you've put a lot of horses through the stable here, and there are a lot of them still here. What horse has most surpassed your expectations to date?
Good question. Say Pocahontas.
He was always a nice horse.
Yeah.
That Pocahontas that Cheryl's on about was fourth in a 150 tonight in Stockholm, but he was always a nice jumper.
He
was just a little bit over careful as a young horse, maybe, and a bit shy. Sure, it's kind of hard to pick one, I suppose, when I'm thinking through them. But even when I think about the best horse that we ever had here, was Going Global. I mean, he was, when you speak about him, I remember seeing him as a 3-year-old in Tom Brennan's, and we liked him. And then the horses with Francis Connors as a 4-year-old, and he was a big, weak horse. Tom absolutely believed in him, but he's great belief in his horses, and he's so passionate about it. But I do remember when I rode the horse here, when he came to me as a 5-year-old, the first time I rode him, like, I could not have said on that particular day that horse will be anything to do with the horse he turned out to be. So it's interesting how that whole story unfolded, to be honest about it.
And what do you think it was, looking back? You had a lot of great days, great experience, Saga Can wins, getting to represent Ireland at the Olympic Games. Like, it's in that one horse, you probably got to tick a lot of things off the bucket list that any one rider would like to do in their career. What was it about him as a horse or an individual that made him that extra bit special?
Well, obviously he had a lot of good qualities, in the sense he was a very brave horse. He was a very sound horse, and that's huge, because you could work that horse a lot and train him a lot, and he was very trainable. And when you trained him and worked him, he always got better from it. Some horses, when you give them hard work or you work, train them a lot on the flat and stuff, you feel them the next day they're a bit stiffer or a bit pottery from the work. He had a lot of character, so you had to work him hard, otherwise he'd take the mickey out of you, basically. But he'd always be better the next day for it, and he'd always be moving better from it, and he was very good that way. He was not afraid of a big occasion. He always was... He was very sure of his own ability, in the sense that if it was a normal 140 and you rode him with no leg, you wouldn't have been impressed if you didn't know the horse. Like, I always remember jumping the horse as a 9-year-old with Robert Splane, who was our chef de keep. The first couple of Nations Cups we did, when you'd watch him the first day in the 140, 145, he'd always be a bit doubtful. He'd say to me, "Geez, are you sure that horse is in form for the Nations Cup the next day?" I said, "Geez, he feels great," but I knew the horse so well, like, I say, "He feels great. I know that when I up the canter and push him a bit more together, or you'd work him a little bit more to get him a bit more connected on the Friday morning at the Nations Cup, you put your boots that you'd use behind, or you had your program with the horse, he'd come alive for you then and everything would be good." But he wasn't a show off over fences when he didn't look for it. And that was probably a good thing about him. Like, he really delivered on the big days, because he really knew when the big day was coming, and the days in between you could really let him switch off, and it'd be very easy on himself. And then he was a very easy horse to switch on. But when you asked what was the best thing about him, is he had massive scope, he had blood, he was careful, and when you worked him in the right way in the flat, he was very rideable. That was probably the key to him as a young horse. He had a bit of character, and he was difficult to get him really soft on the flat. And when you had him really soft on the flat, he was an absolute machine. When that horse was able to canter up to the jump, slow down, soften into the bridle and stay pushing from behind, he jumped like an absolute superstar, like he was. And when he'd canter up and you'd go to slow him down to give him time in the fence, if he was not soft enough in the mouth, and he was a bit joy against Johan as you were slowing down, the jump would get very inconsistent. And that got better with age, but he just came in here tonight. Michael Cork, who was obviously renowned for flat work, he helped me a lot with the horse, and I would say that I learned an awful lot from that horse's development through the years to see how he changed. But I never had a doubt that the horse was, even as a 5-year-old, that he was going to be, as crazy as it sounds now, that he was an Olympic horse. But probably other people at the time were probably thinking that lad is for the birds, like that horse is not anything to do with a horse for the Olympics. And like every horse, there was people that were his fans as well that thought he absolutely was and it was going to happen. But I never doubted it for 1 minute. But I remember working him here, we spoke about it last week, we had a laugh about it, and when he was 6, taking him to Dublin, and we went flatting him here in the grass field at the front. We just asked him to do some exercises on the flat, like he was like, "I'm no, that's not
interesting."
And my God, talk about fireworks! Like he detested you now, you know. But he was well able to do it, but he just had character, and he was a bit like, "No, I'm not. You can not today." Like, and then I felt those 2 days that we flatted him, Michael helped me. I never felt horse actually relax and get so soft on the flat. And when he got so soft and relaxed and so connected on the flat, the jump was unbelievable. I never actually felt, I thought I could get horses good on the flat before. And then it was like a light switch moment for me. I was like, Jesus, I've never actually, this is different completely. And at that stage I was winning, not World Cups, but in the young horse classes, I was winning most of the young horse championships and different things. But those 2 days was like a difference for me. It brought me to a different level with the horse. And then he went to Dublin and he jumped outstanding. But it was, I had such a good connection with the horse between my hand and leg there that the horse jumped unbelievable. And then, like, as a 6-year-old leaving Dublin, like, there was people had offered €1 million for him already as a 6-year-old. So, like, it was, and it just went from there. But you talk about the importance of flat work and the systematic side of things. I remember it did take a bit of work to get him that soft, especially when he was younger. He got better with it with age. I remember bringing him to Dublin as an 8-year-old, and I was jumping him in the internationals. I was national champion in Ireland with him when he was 8, so I got the ticket for the 5-star in Dublin. And we worked really, like, had a discipline plan for the horse and his flat work, and worked him really towards Dublin. And he was 3rd in the small Grand Prix on this Saturday, which was a huge thing for an 8-year-old, 5-star show. And the horse jumped absolutely outstanding. He was the talk of a lot of Europe, I'd say, at that stage, that he looked like one of the best 8-year-olds coming through. And the final of the national championships, because it was a league, the final part of the league was 2 weeks after Dublin in Coilug. And I completely backed off him after Dublin to let the horse relax again and just hacked him out and put him in the paddocks. And so I took him to Coilug, which was a good step down from Dublin. Probably not so disciplined with our plan for there. And he still jumped clear in the 150. But like as a rider riding him around, like it felt like I could have had 2 or 3 down, because every time I canter up to the fence and look for the softness for him to connect into the push through the bridle, he was resisting it and he was throwing toes at jumps and then tightening behind, and it just wasn't the same. It wasn't the same horse. Like if someone looked at the horse in Dublin 2 weeks before in the videos and 2 weeks after in Coilug, you couldn't have said it was the same horse. But it was absolutely everything to do with how the horse was ridden coming to Dublin, like the connection that it had between the hand and leg for the horse. When the horse was soft, he was a machine, and when he wasn't as connected, he just didn't jump the same way, I suppose. And with strength and with, I suppose, a good system, that got better with age, that he held on to that more himself rather than having to encourage it out of him so much. So I would say, like what we said about it, just to have seen how that horse developed and changed, and watching all these videos of him from 5 to 10, that's unbelievable. And I'm going on about it a little bit, but I suppose it was a long journey with him. But I found he was a brilliant Nations Cup horse, and he's 9 and 10 year old year, he jumped so many double clears. But then after the Olympics, as a 10-year-old, I said now it's time that he learns to get really fast and competitive again, because I didn't use him in so many Grand Prix, only Nations Cups, then I'd rest him. And I took him to Spruce Meadows, and he really grew up there after the Olympics in 2016. Like, he was double clearing the 160 the first day, and I thought I went fast, and I finished 8th in the first Grand Prix qualifier. I was like, Jesus, that was slow. I thought I was going fast, but I wasn't fast. And then the second day in the 160, he was double clearing, and I was 3rd, and I was like, now he's getting it. And then he was 5th in the Grand Prix on the Sunday. And then we went from there to Barcelona, and that was my last show with him. But he was 2nd in the Grand Prix in Barcelona. But it was the first time that I ever rode him as a 10-year-old that I felt like I could go fast at the verticals at 160, and he wasn't going to knock one down. Before that, I always taught him to canter up and slow down and make the shape. Canter up, slow down, make the shape. Or I found that if I didn't do that on the verticals, he'd twist a little or screw. Sometimes you had to hold him square. But I thought that it was until September of his 10-year-old year that he was actually, you could keep going at the end. You didn't need to give him that steady 2 strides in front of the verticals to keep his jump square. He was actually able to do it himself, and he was 2nd in the Grand Prix. He was only 0.08 of a second off the winner that day. Like, that was his, that was my last Grand Prix with him. He was 2nd, but it was just interesting. You seen the you felt how the horse developed, but it was to his nearly the, basically you could say the end of his 10-year-old year before that he felt like he could actually win. If he could jump double clear Nations Cups, because he had to do it inside the time, but to go fast at 160, he was just getting it. But I suppose he was only a 10-year-old, and but it's very educational to ride horses like that and feel how they do stay improving and developing.
In the years since, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you've had a few quite unfortunate injuries,
yeah,
that have probably slowed down the international side of
yeah,
your career. Now, but that has its knock-on benefits in that you can focus more on coaching and dealing. But what are your own sporting ambitions still? Or have you switched your focus more on your team's sporting ambitions?
Well, when you're lucky enough to have riders like we have here, you have to take care of them with horsepower as well, or you can't expect them to stay with you. So I suppose the thing for me, the way I look at the horses is, some riders have a stable and they really want to ride the horses themselves, and that's why they do it. With me, I don't really mind who ride. We want to have good horses in the yard and keep making that side of things better, as good as we can do it. I don't mind who rides them, as long as when you look at the horse, you see that the horse is pretty much doing the rider's getting the best out of him, or getting a good tune out of him, you could say, anyways. Whether that's me, or whether at a given time it's Leah or Niamh or whoever is here at any given time, I don't mind, as long as you look at the horse and you say that horse is improving and getting better. So would I like to get back to a high level myself? I definitely would, but I have had injuries and I have had problems with my hip, both of them actually, and so I also don't want to fool myself in the sense that I'm not going to be doing it if someone else is doing it better, because there's so many other responsibilities in the yard,
yeah,
as well, if you know what I mean. So,
what I was curious as a lead on to that is, as I mentioned at the start of the interview, you're really in the depth of the prep and the videos and getting all the content together around the auction. If the phone rings tomorrow and somebody wants to buy one from the auction specifically to leave with you to give it another crack, which is the horse you'd like for yourself, for your own career?
Jeez. Sure, there's a very nice group of horses. The 7-year-old that was 3rd in Zangerside, that Michael Duffy rode, is an amazing horse. Cheryl bred him here. He's out of a mare, jumped 160 by OBS quality, and he's by Cumilfo. So you were talking about breeding side of things. That was a perfect match. He had a big scopy mare, Goodwin's Loyalty, covered her with Cumilfo, and luckily enough, he got the best of both worlds for a show jumper. He looks like a brilliant horse. Sure, he was very little done, went to Lanigan. I know he had a top jockey on board, and he did an amazing job, Michael, but still takes a good horse. That 7-year-old class, there's just no hiding place in Lanigan. So he's gone there, the toughest class for any young horse before they step into international full-on division, and he was 3rd there and jumped outstanding. For me, that's an absolute championship horse that with the right rider will jump an Olympic Games or European Championships or any of that level. And then we have obviously the mare that won the 5-year-olds. She's a class mare.
Yeah,
she's a different type to this, the horse that was in the 7-year-olds. She's all very light, very blood, like a really horse that would suit the likes of Ken Farrington.
That's exactly who just came into my head.
These kind of riders are, we're lucky enough to work with Charlotte Jacobs. and Matt Calderwood and the team in North Star, and she has a horse called Rincoola Milshawn, and that horse has been outstanding for her, but she was outstanding for him, like they were a match made in heaven. And she can just run and jump with horses, and a rider like that with that mare, you just don't know where they end up. Like, that mare is a freak, definitely. So she's a class horse, and I know you've asked me about one, but I actually do think that there's several horses in that class, or in that auction, that are fantastic. There's an Emerald Untouchable, Janus, the Veins. It's a huge scope. If I was probably making up a horse for myself to be a Grand Prix horse, I'd love him, because he's a horse you can really make. He's huge scope, big stride. You can, the more you flat him and put him in a system, the better he's going to get. And there's a Jasmine Dariel. He's a Panama Tame Diamant. A beautiful horse, well, very modern, light scope, careful. He's a class horse. So I think
you're going to have a string.
There's a right good bunch of horses, and if a rider invested in some of those, I'm certain there's going to be several horses in that group of horses. Mark my words, if people follow them, there'll be several horses out of that group that will go and jump 5-star Grand Prix, I'm sure of it. But they have to end up in the right addresses, and like I said, they have to stay healthy and sound, and there's a lot to go through it. But if the horses stay lucky, there's a top class bunch of animals in the auction this year, so fingers crossed.
In the reverse of it, in terms of the investment, you've put some serious investment over the last few years into buying colt foals or young stallions from some of the top dam lines that are out there. Is there a particular mare or a particular dam line that is really on your wish list to get a stallion from, or a stallion prospect from? So we'll start with you, Cheryl, and then you give Greg a minute.
Well, I suppose just going to the mare line, I like the, obviously the mares go back to Chinchin, like the Narcotic Demuse, Olivia Demuse we had from that line. I think she was an amazing mare. We got a lot of embryos from her when she was here, and she was sold to Paracelum, and Niamh McAvoy rode her also here, and I just love her pedigrees. Really, really good, not just up front, you know, she has a batch up right down to the third dam, and it just keeps coming through and coming through again. I just love that family, always did. The Himond family, obviously, again. And we actually have a very nice, very demuse, the Cartago horse from Azuela.
He looks special.
Yeah, he's very good. But again, you have a very strong dam line there that keeps coming through again. You know, it's not just a fluke that these horses are coming from those good mares, you know. I know they're getting good stallions, but they're also producing very good horses.
Strong genetic there.
Genetics there, you know. So obviously I like those family a lot. Like,
is there it can be a mare here that you have that you'd love a stallion from in the future, or a breeding or a sport mare outside of the farm or the stable that you, or a dam line that you think you'd really love to get a...
If you're to talk to me about a mare, we have a few mares. I think we have Sharapur here from Kevin Babin.
Mm-hmm.
She was second in the Grand Prix in Dublin. She was blood, real, like elastic, run at the jumps forward, modern, exactly what you want in a modern horse. She should, you'd be hoping, breed something very special, but they're only coming out of her now. That type of horse, but it's a bit similar to Orange de Bougie, the mare that won the 5-year-olds. She's not from a famous mother line, so it's, the problem is there's so many well bred horses now with ICSI and embryos and stuff that it's hard for a stallion from not a famous mother line, especially when they're young, to get a look in, because when they're young people are obviously going to go for the genetic. But sure, if you could breed her in a 16-2 or 3 stallion with that instinct that she has, with a bit more like not obvious scope, I suppose. Sure, I mean that's you have a dream horse then. If you're to ask about the mare lines, one mare I'm crazy about is, we have a lot from Hiamont.
Yeah.
So we have Seville and the Burghove. Was Niamh would have won the 7-year-olds in Lanigan this year with her. She'd the last fence down. That mare has unbelievable scope. She's not the biggest mare in the world, but she's like 2 meters of scope. There's no fences too big for her, and she's very blood, and it's a good line.
Yeah.
So I would imagine she should breed well. Now we've some progeny coming from her, and hopefully that works. There's two Diamond mares, full sisters, Gatusha and Hiamont, and I really like the offspring from Gatusha. And then Paris Selin, who's a good friend of ours, has a daughter of Gatusha called Atusha. And if I was to get something out of a mare, I would say her. Like, I rode her just a couple of times in Spain for Paris, just even on the flat, just playing about with her, and I see how she jumps with her and how she was as a young horse in Belgium before Paris bought her. And I see that family, like, I would love, hopefully she comes here to breed when she's finished. Cheryl has Cassandra, the good mare from Paris, that jumped five stars, was an outstanding mare for Paris, and she's here breeding. We're very thankful to have her here. But if Atusha ever finished, I would, well, at some stage she will finish her career, that's a mare I would really love to have offspring from. As you know, she's Agonix, Diamond, Darkon, and Ocean and Rosecker. So it's like, it's a fantastic family, and I just think that mare, she's so careful, so smart, and she's just a class mare with a great pedigree. Like, I'd be shocked if she doesn't breed something. And like, that family just keeps coming up. Like, the genetic is so strong there in that family that I'd be shocked if something good doesn't come. And then we were lucky enough actually to buy, we bought an embryo when Luke Henry was having his closing down sale. Carlos Pinto and myself bought an embryo by, so it's a full sister, was a full sibling to Atusha, Paris's mare. We actually thought it would be born a colt, but it was born a filly. So that's a 3-year-old now, and she's just been broken. But she has a Mosito filly foal, and she's back in foal to
Corner Lublinski, is it?
She's in foal to Corner Lublinski, and she jumps top class as well. So maybe we have our own Atusha there, we'll see. But she's a lovely mare. So we'll break her just to have her riding around over a small course, and then we'll back off to work again. She'll have her foal, and then she'll have had two foals herself, and then we'll start to concentrate on working her, and maybe if we get a couple of embryos along the way. But she looks like a really nice mare with a good pedigree. So there's several there, but we'll see. Hopefully we'll have another conversation in 4 or 5 years time. We'll have a few better horses to talk about.
What I was curious with, so at your stallion show this year, like, there was a very impressive collection of young stallions, and it's like, you know, one page is stronger than the next. So what I was curious to do with you is, I'd like to do kind of a little bit of quick fire answers. I don't mind who answers the question first. I'd like to give a trait. I'll mention a trait. And I'd like you to tell me which of your young stallions you feel is the strongest in that trait, or most represents that trait.
Perfect.
So the most naturally careful.
Jericho, I'd say.
Scopiest.
Rock and Roll.
Best rideability, or the most rideable.
Girardeau, Rock and Roll, probably. They're all very rideable.
We're probably a little bit lucky in that sense, the stallions we have. Rock and Roll is so rideable, and Jericho is very, very easy horse to ride as well. So I think most of them would fit into that category, and then the younger ones coming behind, we haven't done enough with them yet. So.
Okay. Who's the best mover?
Girardeau's are very good movers, and Verbia de Muse, the foals are not coming yet, but we spoke earlier about a horse with mechanics. Like, his trot and his canter are like perfect. So you'd hope, like, he's, if you want to design a horse out of should trot and canter, you'd nearly go with how Verbia moves himself, like how his body moves. So hopefully that's a good sign. But he's a 3-year-old, like he's an all to prove yet. Yeah.
And then lastly, what's the stallion with the best mentality or the best brain?
Rock and Roll as well, I'd say.
Ulrich is very good too.
Yeah. Ulrich is the emerald out of the sister, half-sister to Bidia Glasgow. He has a good mentality now as well. He's a lovely horse. But I would say a lot of our stallions are maybe some of the Belgian breeding, and they're quite steady horses, you know. They're not hyper. Which is interesting about, you talk about the carefulness of horses as well. We had Nadim Ilfoh, we showed him in our stallion show here in April or March time, and like, what a jumper, like, he's an absolute machine. His family wasn't a famous family, but he was coming for Cannon, and myself and Shane Breen bought him last year in England. And I would say of every horse that jumped in the World Championships this year, the horse is sold now to America, to Charlotte Jacobs. And but of all the horses that jumped in Lanaken this year, I don't think that there was, if someone was to pick three horses out of the whole championships, I would say most people would have had a wish list of Nadim and Fo. But like, he jumped here at our standing show and he jumped brilliant. But he only covered about 8 mares this year. Like, nobody latched onto him, which was interesting. And we didn't really mind so much. We weren't pushing him so much, because when Shane and I bought him, we were thinking more of a sport horse than a stallion. But you just reminded me, when you said which one was most careful, like, he was electric careful and all reflexes. But people didn't the breeders didn't latch onto him, so it is a little bit of a fashion. But it's interesting, that's all, just to see the way people gravitate towards some horses and not towards others, you know. Word of mouth's a big thing.
Yeah. We've touched on it a few times throughout the conversation in terms of the staff, the team, the calibre of young riders that you have here. And both at the yard here and with other riders outside, you're regarded as a very good coach, very good on the ground with people. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? What do you think makes you an effective coach or trainer for these young riders? Because those riders come in, and of course they have ability, but in a relatively short space of time, you take them from a good rider to a very competitive, successful rider, and you've done that on a number of cases. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, what do you think makes you so effective with these young riders?
I don't know, to be honest. I'd say big thing is you give them structure anyway, like, as such, in the sense that, like, what I spoke about all the time, the flat work. I mean, no matter how good someone rides, if you feel that your horse rides better, it gives you options in the ring. If plan A is not working, you have a plan B and a plan C, like, and that's a massive thing if you're riding in the ring. That if you're losing control and different things, you're only hoping the horse canters down and jumps, clears the jump for you. If you're able to present it to the fence in a certain way and help it, because you're not getting its way because you've made it so soft to ride, that when you're helping it, you're not blocking its jump because it's with you, it's not against you, the horse. Then that's a big thing, and I think that's, I would say that helps a lot of the riders that are here. As well as that, there's a few good riders here riding together now, so that when they're riding and training, they're all feeding off each other and getting better from that. And just the other side of it is, when you have enough experience, that you have so many horses around you for a number of years, that you've seen a lot of different scenarios and you've seen a lot of different horses and different ways of going, so you can relate to it and you can sit on the horse and help with them and different things. So I suppose the fact that you have seen horses from every age group, like from 3-year-olds to 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, up to horses that have jumped at a 160 level, then you can definitely relate to things and you've lived through it. It's not just the practical side of it, it's also your head as well, your emotional side of it. Like, there's a good bit to it. Like, it's like any sport, but definitely in show jumping, like, it's, you know, there's most people that are good at the job are hard on themselves, you know. They're not that cocky in themselves. There are a few that have savage belief in themselves and good on them, but there's a lot that don't, that are very good, that should have more belief in themselves. And it's just also to understand that side of things, like how down you can get when you have a round that doesn't go your way, or how hard those days can be, like, and that you just need to stay positive, that absolutely everybody has those. But I see that a lot. I would say I was like that way a lot, like you'd be in the horrors in your own head about how the thing would be going, but maybe from a lot of people in the outside looking in, they think you're absolutely flying.
Yeah.
It's shaking that off and making young riders understand that that's a very normal way to feel, and that, like, you have to absolutely understand that how good they are and be positive about it and not let that get in the way, because, like, we're losing the majority of the time in show jumping, we're winning an odd time. That's just absolutely very normal part of it, and just becoming okay with that, I suppose, you know. So, like, keeping a positive frame of mind as well is definitely important. And I said, and then all the other parts to go with it, just try to get them to be competitive and disciplined with their flat work. And if you can do that and have a good horse and try and keep better in the horses you're riding, you're going to be there thereabouts, I think.
Yeah. Obviously, there's a collection of very talented young riders here at the moment, and there have been good young riders have come and gone in the past. But when you're looking at potentially taking on a younger rider in the stable here, what are the most important things that you're looking for? Not necessarily just to do with their ability to ride a horse.
I suppose the same things in every walk of life, like that somebody's a good personality for the job, that they're humble and eager to learn, and I suppose that's very important that they're able to get along, because there is a big team here. I think that side of things, you can't underestimate that people are constantly going out trying to better things and make things better and trying to find a way to improve the smaller details. And you do see that, like, you see that in the riders, that or any walk of life, even the people that are managing the yard or the grooms or everybody that's all a part of the team, the people that are constantly just trying to do things better and improve, like, they make such a difference to the whole outfit, if you know what I mean. And you see that in the riders as well, that you know the ones that will go on and generally that will improve and keep developing, if you know what I mean. It's a lot to do with the personality of them, I think.
I'm nearly at my final question, but I'm curious from both the breeding perspective and the sport perspective, if we were to have this conversation again in 10 years' time, we can start with breeding, Cheryl. Describe to me what you want the picture to look like in the breeding program. What is it that you want to have achieved, or what do you want to be different than it is now in 10 years' time?
Well, I think for me, I walk the Aga Khan track, but in Dublin, but I also walked the Grand Prix track. And I just think for me, it's a horse that can jump around clear there, because it's unbelievable. Like, for any breeder, they should try and get in and walk that track, because it would put the hair standing on the back of your neck, you know? And to have a horse that can jump around there clear, you know, okay, you breed a horse and you see it jump in a tree and you see it jump in four or whatever, and like, but you're so far still away from that. But if you can keep focusing on those, you know, to get a five-star horse that can actually jump around those, that for me would be amazing. And that's what I would set my sights on, you know, that we can do that and we can continue to do it, you know.
Consistently,
yeah. I think it's just, you know, it's breeders should probably be in there doing that more often, walk the tracks. And that's why I always say that the breeders need to probably be more in contact with riders if they can. You know, because it's very hard in a breeder just to be doing their own thing all the time and not getting advice from outside or people who are travelling around and going to shows and seeing what's happening, see what kind of horses riders are looking for, see what's commercial at the moment, you know. Because sometimes we can get stuck in our own bubble and we think that all our geese are swans, you know what I mean? And that's just the way for everybody. But unfortunately, you know, not everything we breed is going to work out well, but we can try and change things around, get advice from others, and you know, watch. It's so easy for breeders now to get access to those shows like Clip My Horse, and you know, even if you're not traveling around, watch those big competitions, see what's working, see what stallions are doing well, get advice from other breeders, riders, you know, just keep getting yourself out there, I suppose, you know.
Yeah,
and I think that will all help us, and hopefully that we consistently keep breeding five-star horses, I hope. For me, that's the goal.
What do you want the picture to look like, or what is it from either a sport or business perspective that you want this stable to look like or have achieved in 10 years' time?
10 years. Well, I suppose we were, as you say, we were lucky. Back when you go back 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, we were doing a lot more 5-star shows regularly, which was brilliant to do. And then you start to develop the business and really build up the breeding farm and the training side of things here and all, bring the facilities up. But now I would say that when you're doing that, you have a massive expense, so you're a lot of time selling your best horses sooner than maybe you'd want to, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Because obviously the expenses are coming at you so much. But I would say definitely the biggest thing for me in the next number of years is that we are back more consistently on a 5-star level, like that we're doing, that we have a team of horses in the global tour.
Nice.
And being the shake-up of being on the Aga Khan more regularly and stuff like that. And and I do think that we're on the right track for that. But it does, when you're building, as I say, when you're building a facility, or if you're trying to buy farms or build the facilities we built in, it's a huge, huge outlay.
Yeah, yeah.
When you don't have another business outside of the show jumping or the sport horses, then you're paying for it out of your yard of horses. Unfortunately, the reality is sometimes people are not knocking the door down for the normal horses we have, or the mediocre ones.
Yeah.
So we have to sell the good ones. But we're in a good position now, I think, where we've a good conveyor belt of good horses built up. We've some lovely 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds coming along. We've great riders, so it's just putting ourselves in that position where we're doing that more consistently. And I think Cheryl is doing a very nice job. We've probably a better herd of mares coming, and you'd be hoping that in out of our breeding system that there'd be better and better horses coming the next number of years. And just that we have, I suppose, more horses that we compete at a higher level from our own breeding program, and that we're more consistently at a high level, like I was saying, and
yeah.
Be a happy man then, to be honest.
And from the business or the dealing perspective, is there an ambition?
Just the ambition is that people see us as that, like, that our horses that we have here, that we're producing here, that are coming from our auctions, that are the equivalent of the best yards in the world. And I don't mean to sound cocky about it, but I think that we're thereabouts now. And you see the list of horses that we've had here and sold in the last number of years. Like, there's a lot of very good horses that are competing at 5-star level. And as I said, it just takes a minute to get yourself in a position where you can go back out when you sell a good horse, that you can go back out, and not just the ones we breed, because it's not, the breeding is one part of what we do. I would say that we're also realistic in that I don't just want to breed good horses, I also we like to buy good horses as well. And if you're taking some of the better ones from your breeding system and you're also buying some of the best 4- and 5- and 6-year-olds around Europe, or 3-year-olds, and you put the good ones from your breeding and the group that you're buying together, and you're putting them in a good program and producing them, bar we're doing something very wrong, there should be more and more very good horses coming out of Ballypatrick. And I would say that we're just consistently on, and I do see the tides turning. Like, there's more people, more good riders, 5-star riders wanting to come here and try horses, and are appreciating that the good horses are, there's a very good chance to get them horses here. So I think that in 8 or 10 years time, it's a very normal thing for top 30 or top 50 riders in the world to come to Ireland to find their next top horse, if you know what I mean. And I think that hasn't been happening so much the last 15 or 20 years. But I do think that's already taken a good turn. There's more better riders basing themselves at home again, and the better riders will produce the horses better, and they'll have collaborations with breeders, and they'll be trying to buy a better young horse. So you'll see, in spite of ourselves, better horses in the country and produced, and that'll attract in better clientele, which hopefully will just bring the whole thing up and up.
Yeah, and it takes time, because for a while there, I suppose there wasn't necessarily the cohort of horses that were either bred or produced here that were actually successful at the top level in show jumping. But now there is that kind of wave, or that consistency. It's not just one horse. There's a cohort of them, so
it's not just horses as well. Like, I remember going to Young Rider Europeans when I was 20 or 21. And of the 10 of us that went, between the 5 on the under 18s and the 5 on the under 21s, I was the only one that stayed at home and based in Ireland. All the other either gave up, or, well, only one gave up, and then others went and based in Europe or America. So if you're taking your, I'm not saying every good young rider in Ireland went to the Europeans that year, but like, if you're taking 10 good riders from that section, and 90% of them are leaving the country, it's not just about the riders, it's also the, you're taking a very big portion of good riders to produce horses and have good horses in their stable out of the country, if you know what I mean.
It's taking the air out of the tyres. Like,
it is, definitely. It's no help. Whereas last year I went to, and this year, but I went to the Young Rider Europeans with Niamh. And of the 10 that won gold medals on teams in Italy and in Holland, 8 and 9 of the group that went are based in Ireland. So like, that's a massive statistic, because a lot of those, if they're high end young riders that are winning team gold medals, they're not going to have a bunch of bad horses around them. They might have some normal ones like we all do, but they'll also have good ones. And that'll, if you've consistently that amount of good riders, they're going to try and keep better horses around them, which will keep a lot more good horses in the country. It'll just attract in better clientele, and then, like as I say about, a rising tide lifts all boats, like, and I think that's starting to happen now. I definitely see a big change there. There's better horses here, people are more focused on keeping better mares,
yeah,
using the better stallions, and you have better jockeys around. So, and as Cheryl said, then you have the breeders have more of a chance to talk to people that are doing more international shows to see what's happening and what's working well. And I think it's all bodes very well, I think, for the next 10 years. Not just for here, but for Ireland in general. I think there's a big turn coming. I think we're going to be on the way back to having a lot more, you're going to see Irish sport horses a lot more regularly on the big stage again.
And that is a huge thing, being exposed to a higher standard as breeders, because when you see our fellow breeders in Holland or Belgium in particular, the accessibility how easy it is for them to be exposed to
Definitely.
Good riders, whether that's good junior or young rider, just people doing what they do well, and good horses and at good shows, that they're constantly being exposed to that and seeing what's required. But we largely have actually been probably starved of it for quite a while here, and it's not everyone that's free to be, you know, getting out of the country and going to shows the whole time and being exposed to that. It needs, until it's easier here, there's not going to be a critical mass of breeders that are coming through.
It's a great country to produce horses, there's no doubt about it, and we constantly produce some good riders, but it's to get a better level of horse and a better blank canvas, like a better raw material into the country, whether it's from breeding them or buying them in.
Yeah.
Even you see Flanders fall auction for the last 8 or 10 years, like you constantly see the Irish flags coming up, like
the
Irish have been in a lot more than me and us. But there's a lot more good pedigrees around, and there's a lot more people trying to do it better than we than you think, and you've been a lot to do with that as well, the amount of good mares you've bought for people. So you'd be very hopeful that there's going to be a lot more high end horses in the country for the show jumping side of things.
That there has to be nearly like a new wave with the material that's here now.
I think definitely.
You've been fortunate in the past and the present to work with some very good breeders, some very supportive breeders. I suppose one of your earliest owners and one of your most loyal owners was the late Dr. Noel Cawley, who would have had a massive influence probably on you both and on all three of us. In terms of what we've all done. And I suppose in more recent times, you're working a lot with Joris Trabander, who's one of the best breeders in the world. Based on your exposure to these breeders, based on your own experience here, the question that I like to end each interview with is, what advice would you offer to a young breeder or to someone at the start of their breeding program? So that's the first part. And then after that, I'd also like to come and get a similar question to a young rider that's setting out to make a career in this industry. So first, if we start with you, Cheryl, in terms of your advice for a young breeder.
I think it's probably get yourself into a very good filly. If you want, you know, if you're starting a foundation mare, try and get yourself into the best genetics possible, you know. I remember Noel Cawley, the one advice he gave me, and he was actually stuck with me, he said, decide what you're breeding for. You know, you're either deciding to breed a event horse, or you're deciding to breed a top level show jumper, and focus on what you want to do. Don't start getting, you know, saying, oh look, this might work this way. Just decide to get your best genetics, cross it with your best stallions, and really focus and get in with the best riders you can, so that you're, you know, as breeders, we're really at the hands of where the horse ends up, you know, how it's developed, how it's produced, you know, to get to its stability, and you need to get him into a good stable. And unfortunately, that's not always possible. So a lot of horses get, you know, slipped through the cracks, that maybe if they were in a better stable, that they could have got to their best potential. So that's why I think it's very important for breeders to stay in contact with riders, stay there, get the advice. I know I probably keep harping on about that, because I know that how important it is for me to be able to get the feedback from here, you know, and then you're going back to the drawing board thinking, okay, what could I change? What do those riders actually want, you know, and then what do I need to change? Because it's all about changing and improving, you know, you can't just stand still. And because the sport is moving at such a, you know, a rapid pace all the time, you know, you're breeding now just for, when you look back even at, you know, the late Con Paris time, Eddie Mackin, what they jumped and what they're jumping now in the sport, you know, the poles are so much lighter, the time allowed is different, you know, the course builders are unbelievable, like, so you just need to, and the horses have to be so athletic now, they have to be fast, they have to be careful, so you really have to keep moving with the times. So, and I think that's just really important for us all, to keep moving, to keep watching what's happening, to keep, you know, change your breeding program just to suit the sport as it's evolving.
Yeah, and actually, just when you said about one of the things with Noel about saying get in with the good riders, while I was driving down here, obviously it's a lengthy drive, and I put on the interview that I did with Noel Cawley a few years ago, and, you know, he'd been so involved in the sector for so long, and he was one of the most established or successful breeders here in recent times. And when I asked him what his proudest moments were, it was actually the days that himself and Greg had in Dublin with Rinkarina and Golden Exchange. that partnership did great things for both of you.
Absolutely.
Like, you had great days and an awful lot of Grand Prix wins with his mares, and then that partnership meant that the majority of his horses that were getting into the system, again, it's back to that above average chance, that they all got the chance to be something.
Yeah. And then that in turn improves your mare, you know.
Definitely.
And improves the
family.
Family, and you know, things, you get a better price for your foal the following year going to an auction, you know, so it all has a spiral effect.
Have you anything to add on the advice to a young breeder, anything that you'd add? Or
well, I have one thing to say about a young breeder and a young rider. The thing about breeding is, don't get fixated on what a mare has done herself, for me, because there's plenty of mares that I've ridden, or there's plenty of mares I've seen ridden over the years and got to a high level and won classes or competed to a high level. And if someone said to me, would I want a replica of that horse again at 4 years old in my indoor, there's some of them might say yeah, there's plenty of them might say absolutely not. So just because a mare has achieved things doesn't mean it's going to be the horse that you want to ride 10 years later, or, you know what I mean? So, like, I think that when the big thing for me, like, people say, oh, mare did this or mare did that, and it's great that they do, but there's plenty of uncommercial horses, mares, that have bad canters and bad mouths that jump around a big class because they're with a rider that doesn't have a brilliant horse at the time, and they can put their heart and soul into that horse and drag results out of it. And that's not really, that's not a road to anywhere as such, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I think that's the glory of breeding with some of the young mares that we have. If you take them in and jump a bunch of two-year-olds, for instance, and you take out the two or three best balanced ones that jump in a natural way, not because they've ever been taught to do it, that's just how they want to do it, because you haven't taught them to do that, you haven't put a specific bridle or a specific flat work on them to show them to jump in that particular shape. That's how they want to jump themselves, that's natural for them, their canter balance and their blood. And I think even if they can only jump 130 in the end and have that balance and that naturalness about them, and you cover them with a Scopie stallion, I think you have a great chance of breeding a good horse. And even if it's not a good horse, if it has the qualities, what I'm saying, you have a very marketable horse that can make you money. And if you can make money, you can take it and reinvest it, and it brings everything up and up and up. And I think that's a massive thing. And for me, don't mind what the mares have done as such. It's a bonus if they've done things. But I think if you can have a good model of a horse with good balance and jump in a good natural way, you have a great chance to breed. If you can get everything together, it's brilliant, but not so many of them exist, or people don't want to sell them. I think if you can get a nice filly from a good line that has a natural way of going, that's a nice type with a good canter and jumps in a good form, and you start to breed with her, you're giving yourself a great chance to breed a good horse, because you can, the accessibility to the high-end stallions with frozen semen is so easy now. And I think that I've seen that in the last number of years in our breeding system, that we've done a bit. We have lots of older mares that have jumped to a high level. But when you jump the young mares, I think that have what I'm saying, they mightn't, I don't know where they'll get to in the end, we'll see, because they'll go through the system and see where they end up. But the ones that have that natural instinct and jump in a very correct way and have the blood and balance, and they're nice types, they're very modern commercial show jump. They're not just modern jumpers, but they're commercial horses. So the offspring, if we can breed that into our offspring as well, like good types that have good balance, then not only do you hope that we breed Aga Khan horses, and we definitely do, but the ones that are not have a chance, if they're the type that I'm saying, they're still very marketable and they have a good value. And therefore you're not just breeding one good horse and then the rest of your business is collapsing because the rest of them are bad looking and horrible to ride. And I think that's a massive part of it. Like, that's very important for us with so many mares, that we breed commercial horses as well. We all, and if you breed a commercial horse that can jump 160, then they're worth so much money. Do you know what I mean? That's what I think. And I think if you're talking to me, asking me about riders, it's a bit what Cheryl said about Noel Cawley. You have to decide what you want. Like, there's plenty of good riders that don't make money out of the sport. They can win a class, but they're not, and that's fine if they have no interest in the commercial side of it. But the biggest difference is there's hundreds of riders that can go in and win a Grand Prix or a ranking class or whatever. But there's very few riders now that can make horses. And the thing about making horses is people that can have a good discipline and a good system on the flat, that you're constantly improving the horse's weaknesses, making it nice to ride, taking it in the ring, not specifically winning classes, but actually teaching the horse something. And if you can educate yourself on that, you're always going to have to make a very good living out of what we do, because there's so few people that are good at that anymore. And there's plenty of people that can go in and win a class, but if they're pulling and dragging and the horses are not nice to ride, grand, they won the class that day, but maybe taking two or three steps backwards. But for instance, if you look at the likes of Francis Connors, who's one of the best producers that I know, you see James Cancruz, he spent two or three years making that horse and flattening him, and you see him in the warm-up ring in the mornings or before the Grand Prix, he's out with his shambong on, or he's working the horse and training it, or you go to a smaller show, he's over in the field where no one else is, and he's constantly just systematic, nice flat work, no hardship, just training the horse to go in a nicer way. And you see now he had the likes of James Cancruz, went to Shane Sweetman, within 6 months the horse is a revelation. Shane's a brilliant rider and a system himself, but there was such a foundation put in there. Then you see that he had Just a Dream that was sold to a German rider now from Iron Dames. So Francis got that horse. He was a boisterous, rude horse with a lot of talent, and he channeled all that, and now he sold that horse for a lot of money, and I don't think anybody would begrudge that man making a lot of money for the work and effort he's put in. So basically what I'm saying is that don't just be a rider that can win a class, educate yourself on how to make a horse as well, because there's a big gap coming in that sense. There's a lot of riders that are not winning classes but can make horses, and it can make turning a nice horse into a very good horse from good system, good training and practice. And I mentioned it earlier about Michael Cork that's here. People like that can train you how to improve a horse and make a horse ride so much better in the flat. But it's definitely a thing I see harder to drill into young riders, is that they just want to think about come off ponies, go to international shows. If that doesn't work out for you, it's a sad, lonely, cold place, and you don't make any money, and it's no livelihood. If you can train yourself to be a rider that can make horses and very good flat work and build the horses up to a high level, if you've a sponsor, you have a very good horse, you can do it to a high level as well. And if you're not lucky enough to hit on that superstar horse, or you don't have the sponsor and you have to sell them, at least you're making good money and you have a very good livelihood out of it. And if the rest comes together, then it's a bonus.
Yeah.
That's probably the one thing that I would say is, it mightn't be what people want to hear, young riders want to hear, but it's extremely important. And that doesn't happen overnight. That takes many, many years. You get young people come at 18, they do 6 months or a year and they think they have it. Not a chance. That's 5 or 6 year job. That takes time. Training, working at it. Work that horse, see how it goes on. The next horse comes along and you're working and training. And that's a constant. You have to constantly stay improving. And you think that when you're 21, you figured it out. You think when you're 25, you figured it out. You knew nothing when you're 21. You get to 30 and you're like, Jesus, I didn't know what I was doing when I was 25, now I know it better. Like, that takes time, but it's very hard to have that mentality when you're young, because all you want to do is win. But I think if you can correlate the both, of course it's good to win, and everybody should be trying to be competitive and in and doing well. But it's the riders that really focus on what I'm saying about the flat work, training the horses, making them nice. I think that's what's made Ballypatrick. The biggest part of what it is that our horses do well, but they go in a very nice way. And it's not acceptable, as far as I can see. I'd rather someone had one down and taught the horse something and they went in a nice way than run around and scrape around over jumps and win a class. That's not producing horses. That's not what we're trying to achieve. You go and you have... Definitely, there's days where it's important to try and win, but have your horse going in a certain way. But you can't have the horse going a certain way if you don't know what you're doing and you're not putting the work in and understanding how to make horses.
Yep.
That's important.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?